Members of the committee, we've got kind of a full agenda today, so I'm hoping you can make your presentation and we can have a discussion about 15 minutes. Does that sound reasonable? Okay. And I think we alerted you to that ahead of time, so appreciate if we could do that. So please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Representative Clark and committee members. My name is Howard Schneider, and I am a senior planner with Dakota County Community Services. Thank you for the opportunity this morning. We'd like to tell you a little bit about the story of Dakota County in terms of issues of affordability and homelessness. First, I'll cover some major trends regarding population, poverty, what we call a housing burden, wages and income. And then my colleagues will talk about what's actually happening in Dakota County with the men, women, children, and families who are facing these issues on a day-to-day basis. So just to quickly acquaint us with Dakota County, as you can see in this map, Dakota County is in the southeastern portion of the metro area right here, and it's a blend of older cities, developing suburbs, some suburbs that are rather fully developed, and rural areas and townships that include some cities of just several hundred people. I provided this map here so that you can see where it's located, but I would like to point out, at least from the Metropolitan Council's perspective, we do need to add affordable housing, and they've really highlighted the city of Lakeville, where most of that housing would go during the next decade or two decades. Population growth in Dakota County has continued at a pretty hefty pace. For about 25 years, the county has been the third largest county in the state, reaching, according to the Metro Council estimate, 391,000 people. Since 2000, we've gained the most number of people than any county in the state, about 35,000. Now we move into some of the important issues. In terms of poverty growth, we've seen a consistent growth in poverty in Dakota County. As you can see on this overhead, the growth has been fairly strong at 58% since 1999, reaching a little over 20,000 in 2005, according to the American Community Survey estimate. What this translates into is, according to these U.S. federal standards, for a family of four, poverty is around $20,000. And that would be a wage with the single wage earner in the household of about $9.92 an hour. Now, an important thing in terms of poverty growth is that this is not just occurring in Dakota County. And if you would, for a moment, think of a mental map of where you think poverty is concentrated in the Twin Cities. There are about 232,000 people in poverty in the seven-county metro area. Here we have a map showing the dispersion. 52% of people in poverty live in the two core cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. The remainder, 48% of that 232,000, live in the remainder of Hennepin and Ramsey counties and in the counties of Carver, Dakota, Scott, and Washington counties. So I think our mental map is, or should be changing about where poverty is located. And this is a trend occurring throughout the nation. And in fact, more people in poverty nationwide live outside those core cities where we usually think of poverty being concentrated. As we talk about housing affordability, we like to use a concept called housing burden, which is a readily available and a simple to understand concept. And that is, as you can see, 30% of a household income is used for basic housing costs. When you get to 50%, those households become severely burdened and really are at risk for losing any housing stability that they might have. So what's been happening with this affordability housing burden concept in Dakota County? What we've seen is a pretty steady trend since the year 2000. Housing burden can be applied to both renters and homeowners, or for most part their home purchasers. But in 2000, renters, 38% of renters were paying more than 30% of their household budgets for basic housing costs. They were housing burdened. That grew to nearly half by the year 2005. And even for homeowners with mortgages, that increase has been pretty substantial, growing from 17% to nearly one-third by the year 2005. These are estimates from the American Community Survey, so they may be off a little bit one way or the other, but I think the trend is unmistakable that it is growing. We'd like to focus on rents in Dakota County because that's where we see most of housing instability and homelessness. Average rents in Dakota County have actually remained fairly stable from 2004 through 2006, according to the data collected by our community development agency. We provided for your information 1, 2, and 3-bedroom apartments. They grew quite a bit from 2000 to 2004, but then have leveled off. So here we have a trend of relatively stable rents for the past several years. However, continuing, we find that more people are in that category of being housing burdened. So that equation where we look at what people's income is and what they're paying for a rent, something is happening to cause that burden to increase. What we'd like to point out here, we did some very quick calculations to look at the wages needed for an average rent in Dakota County. And I'll just point out that we'll just take that middle one, the two-bedroom. Average rent is $900. In order not to be burdened, you would need an hourly wage of $17.30 an hour, or about $36,000 a year. Now, are those jobs available to people who live in Dakota County? Well, we live in the Twin City job market. About half the people in Dakota County work outside the county. So we took a look at information from the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And what we found is that of job vacancies that they track twice a year, from 2001 to 2006, in the second quarter, the median wage, 50% or above and 50% or below that number, the median wage rose about 20%, from $10 to $12 an hour. That $12 an hour wage would translate into $24,960. So you'll notice, thinking back to that prior slide, that actually that would be still a burden situation for a household with a single earner living in that household. We do find, however, that about 30% of the jobs, the wages for the job vacancies available in the second quarter, did pay above that $17 wage that would provide an income that would not be result in being in the burden category. Median household income overall has remained relatively steady. This information is from the U.S., one portion of the U.S. Census, and other sources show us a pretty similar trend of median household income and median family income being relatively stable for the last several years. Household income here showing in the mid-60s. And now I'd like to turn this over to my colleague, Mary Beth Lindin.
Welcome to the committee, and if you could just introduce yourself, please.
I work for Dakota County Community Services in the Housing and Resource Development Area, and I oversee our homeless services.
Could you give us the name for the tape, please? Your name?
Mary Beth Lindin.
Lindin, okay.
And when we have so many families at experiencing a housing burden, any of those families, if you lose a job or you have a health care crisis or even a car crisis, can at a minimum will throw you into a financial crisis and in the worst case scenario, into homelessness. And homelessness in the suburban counties is very hidden. As you drive through Dakota County, it looks very wealthy, and you would not know that we're dealing with the homeless issues. Our last point in time survey, so this is just on a given day, we had 80 families that were homeless, and that represented 228 individuals, most of whom were children. We had another 218 single persons that were saying that given night they didn't know where they were going to stay. And so what happens, the face of homelessness in suburban counties, there's a lot of couch hopping. People hop from place to place. If they have a car, they may sleep in their car for the night, but they don't stay in any one given place. So it is very hidden, but it is there. Now, why are people homeless? It's both social and economic issues. For most of the homeless that we deal with, a significant number have mental health issues, drug and alcohol issues, as well as chronic health issues. In addition, there's economic issues and the lack of income. Also, many of our families report that as children, heads of household report as children, they were abused or neglected, and sometimes in our foster care or our residential treatment programs that the county offered. And so they didn't, as children, experience stability, nor do they have stable families to fall back on when they're experiencing a crisis. In terms of income, the majority of the families that we work with have incomes of less than $12 an hour. Many come to us with no income. And if you're a disabled person with mental illness or a chronic physical problem and are receiving Social Security, your income might be about $550 a month. And that $550 a month is a far cry from the $735 a month that you need to stay in housing. Also, about a third of our heads of household have a GED, and in the metro area, the median income of people without a high school diploma is $750 an hour, which again is not enough to support yourself in housing. And a lot of work needs to be done to take head of household person from low income to bring them to a point where maybe they can make $16 or $17 an hour and be able to support themselves in housing. And homelessness actually, I think, caught most suburban counties off guard in the beginning in the early 90s to mid-90s. Howard showed where rents have been relatively stable, but rents increased dramatically during the 90s. And so then from 2000 on, they've been stable. And so we began to see in the early 90s more and more disabled people not able to afford housing, even with Social Security income, and many families falling out of housing. And we did not have an infrastructure even in place. And so we've had to scramble very fast to develop staff that just can respond to homeless issues. We've had to develop shelters for both families and single people. And we've also had to develop housing resources to meet the needs of our homeless individuals and families. And we primarily have used rent assistance in scattered site market housing, and we've brought services to the individuals and families. But we've also learned that that's not sufficient. Some individuals and families need site-based housing, affordable housing, where the services are right on site. So we need to develop for our citizens more supportive housing than we have. We also want to get ahead of the problem and help people before they become homeless. And so we've developed prevention services for individuals and families, and actually the Family Homeless Prevention Program, the state program, has helped us significantly to deal with families and individuals at risk of losing their housing. And the major sources of funding that we've used to develop these resources is a mix of federal, state, and local dollars, and also our nonprofit and our faith-based communities have also been very helpful. But to solve, and if we really want to end homelessness, it really is all levels of government and the community, I think, working together to deal with these issues. What we've learned since we've begun to address homelessness is, first of all, it cuts across everything that Dakota County government tries to do, whether you're an employment counselor and you're trying to help a family on welfare meet their MPIP goals, their work requirements. Stable housing is a factor. If you're a child welfare worker and you're trying to reunite a kid in foster care with their family, stable housing is needed. If you're a correction officer and you're wanting to reduce recidivism for your parolees, stable housing is an issue. If you're a mental health worker and you're trying to keep people out of the hospital and in the community, stable housing is needed to do that. In addition, dollars spent on prevention are very cost effective. You can often prevent homelessness for less than $2,000. An episode of homelessness is very traumatic for the people involved and also very costly for government. But if I leave you with anything today, I think just to let you know that with rent assistance and the right supportive services for people experiencing homelessness, most situations families can be helped to achieve stability. And one of our case managers is here and will give you a story of one of our families, the obstacles they face, and their determination, I think, to overcome those obstacles.
We have a question, and then I'm going to have to ask you to be very brief. We have two bills, and we've gone a little bit over already, so we'd like to hear the story. Can you just hold the question for us?
Okay.
Let's just end. Okay.
My name is Lolly Randon. I'm a case manager with the Dakota County Supportive Housing Program. I've been working with the program for 11 years. And my role is to provide support, guidance, direction, advocacy, and whatever I can to help a person get into their housing and to maintain in their housing and to go from surviving to thriving. And I'd like to tell you a story about Ruby, who's 28 years old, and Andrew, who's 34 years old. They're longtime residents of Dakota County. In fact, Andrew's grandfather is an original homesteader, and his father still lives on the property. They have six children, ages 17 through 2. It's a blended family, two are his, two are hers, and two are theirs. They lost their housing in 2003. They were placed in an emergency shelter. They had to stay there for 2 months until we could obtain a four-bedroom unit for them. While in the shelter, the assessment showed that there was a very poor work history, but sporadic. Ruby had a difficult time maintaining a job because she didn't know job etiquette. He bounced around from job to job. They had chemical dependency issues in their past. Ruby doesn't have a high school diploma. There's no additional training, plus there's this large family, and they had no budgeting skills. We found a four-bedroom unit. The unit costs $1,459 a month in rent, plus utilities, which include heat, electricity, and water. In order to afford this place, the family needs to be making $52,500 a year, which is about $25 an hour. They need housing assistance in order to be able to live within the community that they've always been in. Andrew finally got a good job at a warehouse, and he made $10.50 an hour. He worked there for about a year and found an opportunity that was even better. He went to this new job where he was making $14.50 an hour. Ruby got training through vocational rehab services. A job counselor followed her to work, taught her the skills that she needed. She was able to get a part-time job at a motel at $8 an hour. She became pregnant with their last child, had difficulty with the pregnancy, had to leave that job. But she had enough skills that once she was able to go back to work, she did find employment, although it was difficult because she had to find a place she could walk to. Public transportation isn't as good as it could be in Dakota County. And so she found a job at a little restaurant, and she makes $6.25 an hour. She makes sandwiches. Andrew, unfortunately, was injured on his job. He since has had to have two surgeries. This job was a great job. He had lots of job potential. He is still on workman's compensation. Between Ruby's income and his income, they earn about $26,600 a month. That's $1,279. As I said, they need to be making $25 an hour just to afford this place. What has kept them successful is that they have had housing assistance. We've used HUD dollars. Now they're being supported through direct county dollars. They have support. They get child care assistance. I'm there to provide any kind of direction, guidance, referrals that they need. They're really great parents. A couple of the kids have issues. They've learned how to work with therapists and counselors in the school. And one of the things that they're extremely proud of is they're current on their bills. And if you remember, I said they were just have poor credit and terrible at budgeting, and everything's current. So they're really doing well. So all we need is permanent ongoing housing assistance to make this family successful. They're doing as good as any family could be expected to do. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Vanden. I believe there's a question. Excuse me, Ms. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This message is, or question is for Ms. Lundeen. You mentioned major sources of homeless funding, and you mentioned the faith-based community. You don't have any percentages in there as far as amounts of dollars or amounts of help that you get, but I'm just, because you mentioned it, I added into the other four that you, on your slide. How much of your reliance is on faith-based helping out in your situation with homeless?
Where the faith-based community is involved is in prevention. I mean, they have many families that I think are burdened, and when they have experience a crisis, are able to help. But it in no way, I mean, our churches say to us that they're very strapped, and in no way without other government supports can they really meet the needs related to homelessness. But they're very involved in prevention efforts and also working with some of our homeless families. But I don't have a dollar amount.
Well, thank you very much for coming and giving us that overview of one of our counties. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Okay, we do have two bills before us, and we'll do our best to get through them today. We do intend to vote on them if at all possible. The first bill is Representative Lesh. Is he here?
Oh, yes.
Welcome to the committee. And Representative Lesh, we're going to try to make sure we get through your bill and we have testimony on both sides of that. And if you could keep it about 15 minutes for your side, would that work?
I think so, Madam Chair.
Okay. Just try the best you can.
I'll use my auctioneer voice.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Madam Chair, members of the committee. First of all, are we moving this? And I don't know where it's going.
Yes. The bill will be going to passing. If it's passed here, it'll go to the floor and be re-referred to the Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee.
Okay. Thank you.
So,
yeah, I can move. I'll move that we, as it gets through here, that it moves on to the Civil Justice Committee.
Thank you, Representative Harris. So may I begin, Madam Chair?
Absolutely.
I guess, first of all, to discuss this bill, the question is, where did this thing come from? Well, it came from when I was a poor college student schlepping around trying to find a place and having to look at different options to find apartments, and having landlords charge fees, application fees, which they reasonably did, in order to make sure I was qualified to rent their apartment under their criteria. And I was finding that I would go to different places and they would charge me, you know, $35, $40, $50 to do the same thing that the last guy did. And it just struck me as very inefficient, besides the fact that, you know, I didn't want to pay it. But, you know, it got really expensive. It got up to the point where, you know, it was getting up to about a month's worth of rent to pay for screening fees, which had already been done. When I thought that it would be really nice if there was a system that would make it efficient so you could only have to do this once. I remember when I moved up here to go to law school. I was coming up here from St. Louis. I was getting married that summer. I wasn't married yet. We were looking for a place, and I went to about six or seven different places to find an apartment, and it had to be right close to Hamlin Law School because we only had one car and I had to walk. And so we went in all these different vicinity, but we ended up shelling out about $600 in application fees because we weren't married, and so we had to pay the fee twice so they could screen each of us under the criteria. And that got really expensive. We didn't have that money. I ended up having to borrow some money from a friend in order to pay the application fees, and then gave it back to him when I was working up here. Now, however, I've been a landlord. I've been a landlord for almost 10 years. And in that time, I have people come in and talk with me. I have, you know, a guy coming in with his pregnant girlfriend, and he wants to rent a place. And he's like, "Do you charge an application?" I'm like, "Well, yeah. I mean, I screen everyone." And also, I would note also, I think many of you have been lobbied by opponents of this bill, and it's been suggested that, you know, some people don't screen, and perhaps Representative Lesch doesn't screen as well, and so this bill won't concern him. I assure you that is not the case. I screen very, very thoroughly all of the tenants that I have. I know this because I'm a prosecutor. I'm very well aware of some of the problems that some tenants may have and their history. It's very important for me to get a quality criminal background check, credit check, and rental history check to ensure that this is going to be a good working relationship between myself and my tenant, that they don't bother my other tenants, which is very important because I have good tenants, and my neighbors. I have very good neighbors upon whom I rely to tell me if there's anything going wrong. So I thought, you know, this guy comes in with his pregnant girlfriend, and I tell him, "Yep, sorry, it's going to be $80 between the both of you. You got to fill this thing out." It would be nice if I had from him a certified report that I could rely on, the fact that it was accurate, to say, this is all I need. I can look at it. I'm sorry, but you know, you got two gross misdemeanor passing false checks in the last year. It's just not going to happen. Now, if I'm the kind of landlord that doesn't want to confront him with that on the spot, I can also say, "Well, I'll call you back later." But I thought that it was really important that we have this opportunity. Many of your constituents are paying fees which amount to very quickly approaching a month's worth of rent to do things which have already been done in an inefficient system, an inefficient process. There's no reason for it. All my bill does is provide for a uniform application that each landlord can use and rely on the fact that it is accurate. It is not too onerous in that it uses the current system. The current tenant screening companies, all they have to do is ensure that they're using the standard form. The other issue that may arise, and I would also add that the bill leaves it up to the Attorney General to develop the Uniform Residential Tenant Report. That system is often used by multi-housing. Now also has a uniform application, which I actually use. I pick up from multi-housing the carbon forms, which is really handy. It would be the same kind of process that already occurs. The other question is about the 60 days. This application has to be good for 60 days under my bill. You know, when you go apply, get pre-approved for a mortgage, typically it's good for 3 months, for about 90 days, I believe, last time I checked. I would think that this doesn't even approach that long, but you should be able to reasonably rely on the fact that when you are screened, you've got a certain amount of time to use it when you're looking for a place. 2 months is probably a good window because a previous tenant has to give a notice period plus a day in order to get out of the apartment, and so 2 months I would think would be adequate amount of time for responsible renters to say, "I want to be able to use this for 2 months." Other than that, that's the gist of the bill. In order to keep it short, and I can stand for questions later, Madam Chair.
Sure. Do you have some witnesses that you wanted to have?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. We have, in fact, one of the witnesses who are testifying in support come down. Ron Elwood is here, and Larry McDonough, Paul Bernberg. Are we coming down now?
Let's just come down as a group. And
yeah, come on down as a group.
We'll hear from each of you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, appreciate your listening to me this morning. I'll be very, very brief. My name is Paul Bernberg. I'm the senior housing attorney for Homeline. We're a tenant advocacy nonprofit agency. We run a hotline, do some training of tenants and other people. I came down very briefly to speak in support of the bill. Most of the things I would have said, I think Representative Lesch has already said. I'll just say that I can confirm from our own observations and talking to primarily low-income tenants or tenants that are homeless temporarily, that it gets to be a real burden to lay out application fee after application fee. Your monthly income is, like the ladies from Dakota County talked about, $500 or $600 or $700 a month. You know, three application fees, that's a sixth of your monthly income, and that really puts a dent into you. So if you can get a standard form, I think it's going to be a worthwhile project and a good bill, and that's why we can support it. Nothing more to add unless the committee has questions or other matters.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Brinberg. Okay. You want to bring the next witness? Mr. McDonough. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Lawrence McDonough. I'm an attorney with the Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis. I manage our housing unit, supervise seven attorneys doing landlord-tenant work. I'm also a former landlord. I was a landlord for about 8 years, and I have also lived both in urban areas and rural areas. I started off my practice in the Little Falls area. Basically here to support the bill and to support the testimony of Paul Brinberg. In addition to the fees that tenants face in just applying for apartments, there are basically a tenant, when they move, has to be able to float perhaps 2, 3 to 4 times the rent off to the side to make the transition. Because the tenant has a deposit at the old apartment. To move into the new apartment, they'll have to pay another deposit before they get the last deposit back, which is usually equal to a month's rent. Tenant might also have to pay a first month's rent and sometimes a last month's rent. Okay, so you've got the tenant paying the rent at the last where they are right now. They've got their deposit sitting there, so that's 1 month's rent on the side. Then to move in, they have to pay the deposit for the new place, that's 2, a first month's rent before they move in, okay, so that's 3, and possibly a last month's rent, which is 4, okay. So there's a lot of transitional money that's needed, and if you have to pay, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 application fees while you're looking around and doing this in the process, it gets to be quite a bit. So the effect that we see is often it requires a tenant to stay where maybe they shouldn't stay. A tenant who's maybe in an abusive relationship and needs to move to get out of that relationship, maybe in uninhabitable housing and they need to make the move. And you have these added financial barriers that make it hard to do that. So really anything that can be done to kind of minimize that financial barrier gives tenants more options to live in the kind of habitable housing that this legislature has decided is the type of housing that tenants ought to be living in. And beyond that, I can take any questions if you have.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Mr. Dahl, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Dahl. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. I want to support anything that this committee can do to help make it easier for good tenants to get into rental housing, and this is an area where you can make such a difference. I want to make a case that for people who are homeless and trying to get out of the homeless system into housing that they're contributing their income towards, there are probably 3 reasons why homelessness specifically is impacted by this bill. One is that many of the people who are moving out of the shelter system, they don't just have the transition costs that you were just made aware of, but you have nothing. And so you have the expenses of simply setting up a household and many of the basics that you need to get your home up and running are expenses that these families have, and we try to help them as they're coming out of the homeless system to meet many of those needs, but they have expenses on top of the simple moving expenses and rent expenses. Secondly, I would point out that we are currently putting state money to help people who are homeless get into apartments right now, and part of what we pay for are rent application fees. And if we're putting too much of our money into that process, it's money that we could be spending elsewhere. And so part of the money that shelters spend to help people get into housing, part of the money that we put into the Family Homeless Prevention Program does pay for trying to help people get into to pay the rental application fee. I just want to make one last point, and that's that no doubt people who are homeless, many of them have multiple barriers that they're dealing with to try to get into housing, but some don't. It's simply economics. And I believe the figure is about 14% have no barrier other than they can't afford the housing in the market. And so anything we can do to make the startup costs work for that family, that all they need is to find the right place that costs the right for their income, would go a long way towards helping this population. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Okay. You want one more witness, Mr. Representative?
I believe we have one more witness, Madam Chair. Okay. Susie Brown.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I actually have brief testimony prepared on both bills that you'll be hearing today. I hope it's okay to discuss them both at this time.
Actually, just refer to this one, this bill only, please.
Sure. I'm Susie Brown. I'm the Public Policy Director at Family and Children's Service. Family and Children's Service is a nonprofit organization which each year serves 26,000 of Minnesota's most vulnerable, disenfranchised, and financially marginalized families and children. We support the proposal being considered here today related to tenant application fees. In our work with low-income people, we hear stories of the constant challenges of securing and maintaining affordable housing for families and children. Sometimes it is a chronic lack of resources that separates families from stable and affordable housing opportunities, and other times it's difficulty with the process of getting into affordable housing. Most times it's both. For many families, rental application fees truly represent a significant financial challenge. This increased cost at a time when families need to be prepared to pay rent, deposit, and other costs associated with moving can represent a substantial burden for many low-income families. Worse, if families are required to pay rental application fees for several apartments, while perhaps they're not aware of the criteria or that the landlord is in negotiations with other applicants, the cost can be insurmountable and their resources are wasted. Family and Children's Service supports the proposal described in House File 166 to use a uniform tenant application process in order to help the families and children we serve make the best use of their limited housing resources. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Lesh, got about 2-3 minutes. Did you want to... Any questions from the committee?
Yeah, absolutely. I would stand for questions if need be. But I would just say, before, if there are any questions, I would just add one thing. Members of the committee may be wondering how we can develop a uniform application, and isn't there some things that are going to be left out? The fact is, there are a few major things that need to be included on this, that being criminal background check, residential screening, rental background check, and credit check. Those are three primary things that you need to make. Any responsible landlord is going to have that as a check. There are also some other things that are going to need to be on an application that a landlord is going to want to know. I mean, do you smoke? Do you have pets? You know, how many kids do you have? You allow parties in your apartment. These are different things that, you know, you might be able to get from a Q&A with a prior landlord, but you might not. But the current uniform application that's developed by the Attorney General and used by multi-housing has these questions on it, and also it provides that any falsification of that application is a material breach of the lease as well. So if you lie on the application for something that can't be checked, it's a material breach, and it's grounds for eviction, and that's kind of your remedy in some of these cases where you can't verify it. But the primary thing is that those are the major things that can be determined on the application. It's not like, oh God, what if something comes up and we don't know the questions. We'll be able to develop the questions. It will be in consultation with the Attorney General as well. Other than that, Madam Chair, I just have questions.
Thank you. I think Representative McFarland has a question.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh. I'm not an attorney, so if you could clarify something for me. Is there a difference between an application and a screening? I mean, and are there two different fees with that?
No, there's not. The screening is based on the application.
Okay.
We screen off of the information on the application.
How long does it take to process this if we were to get to wait for their certified copy?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, it should be the same amount of time as we currently have. I believe, depending on how you want it, there are different screening companies that will charge a premium from an expedited screening. But typically, within a week, I'll get information back, sometimes 4 days, or if they're not busy, you can have a 2-day turnaround as well. But that's kind of up to the screening companies.
Okay, so then somebody that wants to apply to more than one place would have to wait till this came back then in order to save the money? I mean, I know that sounds like a dumb question, but... I mean, if they have to wait for a certain number of days to get the certified copy to save the money, they have to wait for this time period in order to get the form from you, right?
Madam Chair, Representative, for the first one, yes. Any subsequent, like, for the first time they rent it, or they could go ahead of time like you do to apply for a mortgage, you go get pre-approved. You know you're going to go out. People are in town for a weekend. They say they're going to come in town to St. Paul, for example, and they're from Omaha. And so they get pre-approved, and then they can just come in town with that in hand rather than, you know, look at apartments over the weekend and then leave and then send them in, and then it's a much longer process.
Representative Medora. Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. I haven't rented in a very, very long time, so forgive me. You're talking about a screening company. Are these companies advertised? How do you know to go to a screening company to get that application process started?
Madam Chair, Representative Medora, landlords, first of all, should be screening. They don't have to screen by law, and we're not requiring them to screen in this. We're just saying that if they charge a fee, they have to use a uniform application. Landlords, if they do screen, should be using a reputable company based on the certain criteria that I laid out before, that they're going to cover all these things, background check, NCIC, credit check, all those things. They're advertised, yes, in the newspaper, and I think I get mail from them. When you, for example, in the city of St. Paul, you're required to register rental properties, and I think they get that list and send out mails, because I get mailers from them once in a while. But they are in the newspaper, and they are in the yellow pages.
Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lesh. I'm all for minimizing government, consolidating forms. I got a couple questions. One in regards to some of the issues we're talking about. You know, when you go in for a credit check for buying a house, typically you go in and the bank says, you got a good credit rating here, don't go out and charge anything until we got this credit rating through.
Yeah.
And then if you do that, you get a good credit rating, you get in, you get the mortgage, you go on. If you go out and charge the world, the bank takes your house. In this particular case, you go out and charge the world, and the renter is now can't pay next month's rent because he's got this huge debt, and now the landlord is stuck with 1 month's rent, and the credit check that he's basically gotten could or could not be valid. The question I've got on this particular issue, if you go 60 days with a longevity life on a credit report, they get the credit report back, they charge the world. Now you have no certification that says the person that gets it 31 days later has a valid credit check. And so they're not actually even, the way I see it, is because in one instance the bank has the note to the house, in the other instance the landlord has got a piece of paper that is no longer valid. Can you address that?
Well, yeah, I could, Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson. That's true. If someone is willing to go ruin their credit rating just to get an apartment, or wait to ruin their credit rating, I should say, just to get an apartment, there are going to be some loopholes a landlord's always going to have to watch out for. I suspect if someone has issues like that where they say, well, you know what, I'm not going to go out and, you know, buy a Lexus on my credit card until I get this apartment, I as a landlord would be kind of stuck. But I would say most landlords know in 90% of the cases, when you have a problem tenant, they're going to have a history. They have the history. You can see the history. You know they've been problems before. Even if it was like 6 years ago. You know, what if someone was in prison for 6 years? We got nothing on them. But 6 years ago, they were causing problems. There probably are some narrow loopholes on lists, like the one you just brought up. But I think I will rarely ever, if ever, run into those.
Madam Chair, one follow-up. I have to read this one statement. I got a letter from a constituent who does affordable housing for the diocese up in the St. Cloud area. It said, we require criminal check history where other landlords do not. We don't rely on credit history because our desire to help individuals with affordable housing, other landlords rely on a... in other words, one relies on a credit history, as you had said, and the other one relies on a criminal history. My question would be, if we do a joint form where you have to go into both the credit history and the criminal history, are we driving up the cost of the credit report so it becomes non-economical for some landlords or some constituents who are requesting the credit history?
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Severson, to some extent, yes, we are. To some extent, in order to provide for a uniform application for Minnesota, we need to make sure that all the information is in there that, that almost all landlords are going to want. And so that's why the fee is up where it is. I don't charge $50. I do as comprehensive fee I can, but just to ensure that everything's in there that everyone's going to want, yeah, the cost goes up a little bit. But the benefit is they only have to pay it once rather than three or four times. And so that's where I think the trade-off makes it beneficial.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this really just about the fee? If I'm a landlord and I don't charge a fee, then I don't have to use this application.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, that's correct. If you don't charge a fee, you don't have to use the application.
Okay. And if they bring me this certified application that they did at a previous place, can I look at that and then opt not to use it, not charge them, and do my own?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, correct.
Okay. So if this goes through, I hope that the Attorney General's office works with the Multi-Housing Association and develops an application that is beneficial to all concerned, because otherwise what we are doing here, you would just end up saying landlords just won't charge a fee. And if they don't charge a fee, they'll take one look at the applicant, they'll make a pocketbook evaluation visually and decide, I don't think I'm going to do something. I mean, they do this like, that's how you buy a horse. You look at it and decide whether your pocketbook can handle it or not. And that you're going to force landlords to start making an observation and saying, if I can charge a fee, I may just have to pass. Is that, am I wrong in that?
Well, no, to some extent, Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I think I'm following you, that you can decide on an ad hoc basis, you know, whether it's a policy of yours or not. We're not looking to have landlords form policies that either you charge a fee for applications or you don't. You get to decide on an ad hoc basis. And if somebody walks in with a certified copy, and you can say, well, you know, I can't charge a fee because they already have a copy of it. But if I'm the type of landlord that doesn't already charge a fee, well, then I can rely on that as gravy. Maybe it covers a lot more than what I would usually request. If it doesn't cover the things I want to know, but there are probably some examples out there that based upon the particular property a landlord is going to want to know, they'll just check on that themselves. But a lot of times tenant screening companies charge a premium for those sort of boutique services, you know, if you want to find out certain other things. But the second part, or first part of your question, absolutely. I think it's critical that the landlords, multi-housing, have substantial input with the Attorney General on how this is developed. Because ideally it's for the benefit of multi-housing and the landlords, and that would be my expectation, that there would be a lot of cooperation in that.
Madam Chair? And a comment, and to hopefully the benefit of the tenant applicant, if it's a form that landlords don't use, you've hurt them. My other concern is, now that you've created this document, do you envision legally that at some point in time this document starts to become grounds for a discrimination in housing? I mean, there's regulations on what landlords have to do in screening applicants and the grounds and how they turn them down. Are we just creating a document here that now creates more legal concern?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, first of all, we already have that document in the form of the standard application that's approved by the Attorney General and used by multi-housing. But there are legal ways to discriminate, and then there are illegal ways to discriminate. The expectation would be that you cannot include in there those things that are illegal to discriminate on. And, you know, if you can try to prove, as some enterprising trial lawyer would, that a person illegally discriminated, even though it's not delineated on the form, well, then that would be a separate issue.
Okay. Let's see if we have Representative Schumper, and then we're going to hear the opponents. Representative Schumper.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesh, will your bill apply statewide? You know, Will it, Madam Chair, be on the chair?
Yes,
it will. I'm just concerned because in, you know, rural areas, people might have a single-family home and so on. Probably in most cases, they don't charge an application fee, so they would not have to comply with it, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Trumper, that's correct. And to answer kind of the first inquiry you made also, that would be the intent, that everyone be included in what needs to be on the form. And this has been done a long time, I mean, in terms of screening for tenants. The technology has been there. So most of the rubric for what you got to check already exists. And if there's something that no one's ever thought of, I'd be really surprised. But we will find that out in the process we work with the Attorney General on it.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I got a couple of questions here. Just first, right now in standard practice, can the fee that a landlord charges be more than what they actually pay for the report?
Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, you can, under current law, charge more than the actual fee requires. I believe I recall something about exorbitant fees, but, you know, the landlord is legally able to compensate for the time that it takes, you know, I mean, to drive it down there, other associated costs. You're not limited to just what it costs you to run it by the tenant screen company.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh. Another question: that if the landlord, or if there's a number of applications that get applied for, or a number of rentals that get applied for, who technically owns the report? If I was number five in the list and I had some questions and I wanted to call the screening company and get some more information, how does that process work? Because I wasn't the one that... I'm not their customer.
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, based upon the language, what you would be able to do as number five landlord is you would have on the uniform application that this came out of Acme Tenant Screening. You would be able to call Acme Tenant Screening and verify. Now, Acme would be within their legal rights to charge you a fee to do that, which you would not then be allowed to pass on to the tenant. But, you know, I would hope that they wouldn't charge the same cost that did the entire thing. Technically, they legally could. But the idea for this certified form would be that you could rely on that, that you wouldn't have to check into it. However, if you did want to, the information would be on there as to who ran it.
Madam Chair. I guess if I was I'm saying that if I was a landlord, and this was law, and maybe I was in a small town and we don't do a lot of screening, we rely more on word of mouth and other things that kind of, because people know people, and so you get a lot of that kind of information. You know, you might change your practice, and the first question you might ask is, have you been screened? Which could actually be detrimental to a tenant if they have something on their record that maybe they would just soon not have be there. You know, so I'm just trying to figure out how this could possibly work. I can see how in some situations this could be very valuable. In other situations, if you don't screen well, what happens to those people? Like oftentimes I just jotted down a couple things. I think if I was going to be the landlord, you know, you'd want to validate employer information. You'd want to validate some income. You'd want to validate. You want to take the references and you'd want to call them. And you want there's some other things that you do here in this screening process that you're not going to be able to recover anything for. So a landlord that wanted to do that would kind of be out in the cold. So I guess that how would those kind of issues resolve?
Well, I guess, Madam Chair, Representative Easton, I would remind you that this only applies if you want to charge the fee to do it. So if you want to do all those things on your own, you are absolutely always free to do on the right. Only applies if you say you, as an applicant, who I request a fee from, then you have to use the uniform thing. But I would say that in kind of in response to what you're saying, you know, there's this sort of fiction that's been perpetuated out there that, well, if you don't screen well, you're SOL. And That's not really true. As we all know, the rental market changes substantially. When I first got into the rental market, I think we had a vacancy in St. Paul like 1%, where I was like, you know, hey, everyone's looking for apartments, and I got the pick, my cream of the crop. But you know, not too many years later, I'm renting to people that I didn't think I'd ever rent to. And I got the stuff on there. You know, I got their history, and I'm like, okay, I guess you're the best I got now, and I did. I rented to them. Some of them worked out, some of them didn't. Part of that is being a new landlord. You know, the only way to learn is the hard way, which I did a couple of times. But you still have the choice. Even if you don't screen well, there are degrees in there. It's not black and white. It's not just, well, this is going to show up, so forget about it. I might as well not even try.
Okay. Committee members, I know there's more questions. I want to make sure that we have a chance for the opposition to give their testimony, and then we'll have Representative Lesh back.
Madam Chair. Thank you. And maybe the opposition might want to react.
Okay. All right.
I might suggest two things. One was from what Representative McFarland said, is if that applicant doesn't get that application, that certified copy, back within a week or two, the person's going to turn them down, doesn't give them back, doesn't give them the copy for 10 days, and yet the 60-day clock is running. You may want to look at that application being returned to them within a period of time, and the 60-day clock corresponds to that. Just a suggestion.
Let's go ahead and hear from the opposition. Representative Fedora, I have you on. We'll come back to you. I know, let's see, Jack Horner? Mr. Horner, I believe, there you are. I believe you have some witnesses that you wanted to bring forward to. And we had about 15 minutes of testimony, and then I think we had about 20 more minutes of questions. So if you can try to do your testimony in about that amount of time, we'll be happy to also give you as many questions, as much questioning time as you need.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jack Horner, representing the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. And also, I'm going to be testifying on behalf of Tony Carroll, president of a company called Rental History Reports, RHR, a reputable, well-known firm who very much wanted to be here today but was not able to. His experience, I think, is very instructive, and I wanted to pass this on to you. Over a couple of year period, 1999 to roughly 2001, he attempted to establish and create a program very similar to Representative Lesh's program, the difference being that he was doing it with landlords and tenants who wanted to be part of the program. He was doing it with all the legalities and the contractual requirements that, unfortunately, Representative Lesh's bill does not allow for. So he would go and have contracts as required with tenants or landlords who would agree to take the reports. The program worked like this. A tenant would come and fill out an application form, and RHR would do the full comprehensive report. They charged a premium. It was about $60, but it was very comprehensive, and it covered in and out of state, and it was good for multiple uses with all these landlords who had previously agreed. The tenant would get a statement, a certificate saying that he had been screened. Now, he would never get the screening report. First of all, you can't do that. Secondly, it immediately makes it unreliable and essentially useless to give the tenant a copy of this report, like any credit transaction. So the tenant would get a copy of a certificate saying he'd been screened, give that to the next landlord. The landlord would then know that he could, at no charge, because that was part of the agreement, that was part of the contract, could call RHR and get the screening report. And so the tenant could then apply multiple places and presumably would be able to alleviate the problem of repeated applications. Well, RHR, over a couple of year period, spent many tens of thousands of dollars and was never able to make it fly. They worked it, they marketed it, they spent money. The problems boiled down to a couple of them primarily. First of all, landlords have different standards. There's a huge difference in tenant screening. Even if you were to use the same form, in standards, in quality, in what to screen for, there are not just a couple of things, there are dozens of things that you might look for. Some landlords want them, some landlords don't, some landlords want more. And so RHR was never able to get the number of landlord customers that they want because some wanted less, some didn't want the full comprehensive report. And the major problem there is the human rights law. It is just fundamental fair housing policy that you cannot screen applicants to different standards. You have to treat applicants uniformly. You have to treat them the same in all respects, same terms and conditions and everything else. You can't screen one tenant to this standard and another tenant to another standard, whether higher or lower. You are just asking for what is the bane of the rental housing industry, for discrimination complaints, threats of complaints, unfounded complaints. If you start doing that, you're simply asking for trouble. So a landlord who doesn't need the full report, he maybe does creditor to criminal, could not accept a report that has the full report because now he's screening tenants to different unequal standards. A major problem, and one of the major problems why they could not get this accepted in as broad a way as necessary. The other problem was from the tenants themselves. The tenants fall into two categories. The great majority who have good records, no problem finding a place. They look at an apartment, they like it, they apply, they're accepted, they move in. This is the majority of tenants. They wouldn't pay the $60. Why should they? They're going to get in for paying the $30 or the $35, the ordinary screening cost. So they wouldn't use it. The only ones that it really was going to be working for was the tenants with the kind of the spotty records, the problem, the blemish on the record. They pay the $60, thinking that they're now sort of guaranteed an apartment. The problem is they weren't. Even with these landlords who had agreed to accept the screening report at face value, the fact is, if you don't have a good record, it doesn't make much difference how many landlords you show it to, how much time you bring it around, it still says you have a bad record, or you've got an event on that disqualifies you. So tenants were paying a premium, being disappointed. Good tenants weren't paying for it because they didn't need to. Landlords found they couldn't use it. And after a great deal of time and effort, he finally abandoned the project. And I'm afraid that that's what this proposal before us today would be leading to. Madam Chair, there's a number of folks here who would like to testify to various aspects of. Does the committee administrator want to call names, or should we invite people up?
Why don't you go ahead and bring your witnesses, and you can introduce them. While we're waiting for your first witness to come up, let me introduce some ninth grade students who are here from Farmington Middle School. Would you like to stand up and be... Oh, seventh grade? Seventh grade. If you'd like to stand up and be recognized, we'd like to welcome you. Real glad you're here. Okay.
Madam Chair, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Mark Otness. I am a property manager. I have property in Minneapolis and St. Paul in the cities, in the surrounding suburbs. And I also have some properties out state, both in Duluth and also in Northfield. I just wanted to reiterate what Jack was saying about that there really isn't a standard tenant screening report. Even if we use the same application, what goes on behind that report is really substantially different. There will be some landlords that only search for the BCA, which would be the more serious crimes. Other landlords, like myself, will drill down to the county records just because we find that to be much more accurate. But even within that, depending on the circumstances of the applicant, we will search different things. It doesn't make any sense to screen someone in the local area if they haven't been in the state of Minnesota. In that situation, we'll go back and we'll screen, you know, wherever they were from, whether it be St. Louis or another state, just to find out what's going on in those locations. So we do that. We also, we see some applicants that are obviously been applying from place to place. But again, as Jack had said, the problems are really fairly obvious. On my application, I have a form that's checked yes or no if you have a criminal record or have a UD on your record. People will check no, and we uniformly find them. You know, if people are really honest about their circumstances and all that, then we don't see that many multiple applications coming through. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. Any questions? Any members? Okay. Next witness, Mr. Herman.
Welcome to the committee. Madam Chair, Representatives, my name is Lisa Marvin. I'm the CEO of Essence Property Management. I'm an instructor for Minnesota Crime Prevention, and I teach for housing for local government in the city. I have three quick points. One of them, a large one, is in my 15 years of doing this, I have rarely seen someone go and apply at 6 and 7 and 8 places, why would you do that? I would go and I would shop like everyone else does and find the apartment I want and then apply. I just don't see it. We have people that come for showings 3, 4, and 5 times. They just want to pick out, lay their furniture out, make sure. But why would you ever go and apply at all these places? You would apply. Some of our staff that we use, we can have an answer in 24 to 48 hours. Some it takes longer if they're Section 42 and so forth. So I guess I just don't believe that there is a problem that has been laid out to you, because you are not required to come to our properties and apply. You are asked to come and look and hopefully find the apartment that is for you and then apply. Before you apply, you go through our screening card test process and you read it. And if you agree to it and understand it, you sign it. And if not, we review each item that's on there. You are well aware what we are screening for before you give us that application fee and deposit to apply. If you are denied, you get your deposit back, but your application is non-refundable because we pay that fee. The second item of huge concern I have is the cities that you are so working for, your constituents, are making it so hard. They're holding us accountable. We have 3 strikes rules. We have nuisance abatements. We are being held on a daily basis accountable for our residents. And by the very means of this bill, you could lessen our screening ability to find these backgrounds that we so need to find. The minute you walk out that door with that form, if you don't believe fraudulence is going to occur or that they're going to forge these forms if there's an issue, you are sadly mistaken. And I strongly also oppose, I believe, I do not know this for a fact, but I believe strongly that it is against the federal law to, you have to show each and every place that views your credit. If I view your credit, it's documented on your credit report. You don't take it and hand it out to show everybody. They stringently do this to make sure that everyone who views your credit is stated on there. So I actually don't even believe that, quite frankly, this could occur, and I ask you to strongly consider that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Marvin. Any questions? Representative.
Ms. Marvin, my question for you is, what's the timing? If I was to come and apply and I visited an apartment and liked it, and gave you whatever the $30 or whatever you charge, and if you'd tell me when you answer how much that is, how soon would you get back to me in either days or hours?
At our market rate, thank you, ma'am. At our market rate properties, usually in about 48 hours. Section 42 compliance, which has to verify all of your income in order to live there, that can take us 4 to 10 days, depending on how fast employers and banks get us back. So there's different housing programs out there, but our market rate ones. It can take a little bit longer if you've come from multiple states, because I do want to verify every state and every county that you've lived in for your criminal record.
Person, Madam Mayor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the fee that you charge?
We currently charge $35.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Horner, do you have another witness?
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Terry Thompson. I'm a Coon Rapids police officer. My current assignment is the community policing segment of our police department, and my primary focus is crime-free multi-housing and multi-housing in general. I'm also an instructor for the crime-free program with the emphasis on tenant screening. I have several concerns with this bill. One of the first concerns would be addressed by the 60 days involved. A person's criminal history can change in 24 hours, much less 60 days. This time frame allows for a myriad of nightmare problems when it comes to trying to efficiently screen applicants and to do so and prevent a problem tenant. A second problem that I can see with this bill is the actual use of a certified copy. We are experiencing right now in the United States an unbelievable problem with check forgeries and forgeries in general. To use a form that anyone can have in their hands and scan into a computer and alter as they see fit invites all kinds of additional problems, forgeries, just on and on. Officer Cowley.
Hi, Madam Chair. Welcome, members of the committee. I'm Officer Jim Cowley, Bloomington Police Department. I've been a police officer for 22 years, and I've been coordinator of our crime-free multi-housing program for the last 9 years, And for those in the audience, go Tigers. I just want to reiterate just briefly here about what Officer Thompson said here, too. Criminal records change daily. Just in Bloomington here, we have a level 3 registered offender that's moving into our town. When we were doing checks on people that were living in our state or in our city, on Monday we had 77 that were registered offenders. On Tuesday we had 75. So these reports change daily, and a 60-day period in there, in my opinion, is just way, way too long. The last thing that I'd like to also add in there, we do have problems as a law enforcement community in verifying driver's licenses, $20 bills and checks. Anybody can get a copy of a formal document and alter it or change it to whatever they want. And giving a certified copy, first of all, the question is who certifies it, but giving a certified copy of a background check to a person, letting it go out the door, where does it go from there? And those are the issues that I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Officer Colley. Questions? Okay, if not, any other witnesses, Mr. Horner?
Yes, Madam Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Josard. I'm President and Chief Operating Officer of Climate Realty Company, a real estate management, apartment management company based in the Twin Cities. We manage 1,800 apartments, 110 properties, and over 1,000 of those are in Minneapolis and St. Paul alone, and a number of suburbs, some outstate properties also, Fergus Falls and Timber, Minnesota. Ms. Marvin expressed the one fee, one apartment concept. I don't want to talk about that anymore. Just to say that she is accurate, that somebody that is a good quality applicant can choose their apartment, apply for it, and get an apartment. We have vacancies, more than I want to have on any given day, and believe me, our goal every day is to prove each and every application that we receive. We want to rent apartments. That's the business we're in. We have bills to pay, like everybody else. But we want to rent those apartments to good people. People are good for the community, good for the state, and good for the building and the others that live there. Effective screening practices has allowed me to meet that goal, and your cities preach and teach it. We just had two officers tell you how important it is. They go to landlords in each of the cities, and they preach it, and they teach it. Screen, screen, screen. I've been doing this for 20 years. I've had minimal crime in my buildings, minimal housing violations, no complaints or lawsuits regarding my policies. We have well-maintained, professional-managed rental properties, which are an asset to all communities. This is my forum, similar to the one that Representative Lesh is discussing, similar to MHA's, although this is RHR's, which is a company that Mr. Horner has expressed in the back, is all of the criteria that we require. Each and everything is discussed on the back of the forum. Meets the Plain Language Act and states that the fee is non-refundable, and the applicant acknowledges and understands the application policies printed on the reverse side of this form, and they sign at the bottom. If they're a decent person and have a good, no criminal background, good rental history, and meet all of the criteria that they have already read, they will be approved to rent their apartments. So basically what I want to say is we all have a little bit different criteria. So the one, just because they're approved by one screening agent doesn't necessarily mean that it will meet my criteria. I may require 3 times the income to rent the apartment. Others may require 2 times the income to rent the apartment. Others may require 2, some 2.5. We all have different criteria. My criminal record criteria may be very and may different too. So I really am not willing to accept somebody else's criteria and have it shoved down my throat. Basically, one form doesn't fit all, nor does one policy fit all. That's true for any business. I guess if you have a problem, I just please ask that you address it on an as-needed or management-by-exception basis. Please allow us to do our job and not control and restrict the information that I need to make sound business decisions for the better of the cities in this state. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Turner, I see you have another witness there. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, actually, we have 5 more.
Well,
could I ask?
We can give you
Could we have maybe 1 minute for each, just a sentence or two from each, Madam Chairman?
Are you
I know we're running we're a minute over.
Sure, okay. If you can really keep it to that, and
okay.
Please help us, Mr. Hunter.
You've been so instructed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Please introduce yourself to the committee, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carol Buca. I'm the CEO of Twin City Tenant Check, Inc., one of the numerous local screening agencies. I'd like to comment specifically on Section 2, Subdivision 1, and that's that there is no definition of certified. I know we've already spoken a little bit about it, but more technically, what does that mean? If you get records from the federal courts, it comes in a sealed envelope with a nice red ribbon and a wax seal. If I get a certified copy from the courts, and I believe the cost at the federal level was about $50. At the county court level, a certified copy has got an embossed seal. Those machines are quite expensive to get, and it's usually some kind of an official seal. I don't have an official seal, and neither do any of my clients. The certified copies at the court level are $10 per document, so if, in fact, I was going to certify someone's criminal record, it could be very costly. I'm also very concerned about the language stating that that my client, the landlord, is going to certify that copy. So someone else is going to certify my work. I'm not at all comfortable with that. Under current law, and Fair Credit Reporting Act and state law, the tenants have an absolute right to obtain a free copy if they're turned down. This is not being used. I see this as a problem of tenant education, consumer education. I get very, very few requests for copies. And if, in fact, they don't know what's on their report, it's easily obtainable. And I know there's stories about how hard it is to get a copy. No, it's not. I can do it in 5 minutes if you're by a fax machine. We don't put any barriers besides requiring a signature on a request to obtain a copy of their report. I'm also concerned that Representative Lesh did not mention the fact that the screening agencies would be included in the discussions with the Attorney General. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. I think you have about 2.5 more minutes. I do want the committee to have some questions. I want the committee to have a chance to ask some questions. So maybe this next witness, if we can wind it up with you, that would be great.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for letting me testify. My name is John Benson. And I'm just a regular guy, a new landlord with 1 4-bedroom rental property. I'd like to share an experience I had recently that has led me to strongly oppose this bill. I screened a married couple. The wife stated that she used to live in Chicago. The husband did not say that he used to live in Chicago. I asked him point blank if he had ever lived there. He said no. But we did a credit check on both of them. And when you apply for credit, your address goes in the credit bureau's history. A Chicago address showed up for him. So we did run a Cook County criminal background check on him, and we found a rap sheet a mile long. There were firearms convictions, there were domestic assault convictions, and I thank the Lord that he applied for credit while he was in Chicago, we wouldn't have had that address, we may not have run that check. And the loophole I see in this, the huge loophole in this bill that I think of as an open door for criminals, is that the criminals in big cities outside of Minnesota, the word is going to get in the street. They're going to hear about how easy it is to come here, ask a friend of theirs to pose as a landlord, run a background check on them that is not going to show a criminal background for the state of Minnesota. And then I'll have no legal grounds to deny them. Child molesters can move into my property, molest the neighbor, and what legal grounds would I have had to deny them? I think that our bad neighborhoods are just going to get worse, and good landlords like me are just going to be tired of the hassle and having to eat the cost of screening criminals who came here just to try to pull a fast one on me. I'm going to be driven out of the business, and the neighborhoods are going to get worse, and landlords are going to be unfairly blamed for it. Thank you.
Thank you. We have used up that extra time, Mr. Horner. What I'd like to do is give the committee members a chance to ask questions, and if you want your witness to answer them, that's fine, but I do want to make sure that we have a chance for Representative Lesh and you to respond to questions. So, Representative Lesh, why don't you come back to the podium, and let's see, we have a lineup here. Representative Mador and Morgan so far, is that right? Okay.
My question will be very short, sure. Madam Chair. My question is specifically, are the screening companies held to the same standard throughout the state? So, for example, if I pick a screening company A and I work with that agency and then I go to an apartment that might, a building that might use screening agency B, are the same requirements required of both, and are they bonded to protect themselves from a lawsuit, say the applicant, because now we've got a next step in the process here with somebody being able to say, this screening company has created a credit problem for me, and I can't rent apartments. So I'm just trying to be a little proactive on that. So are they held to the same level, and are they bonded and licensed in the same, or are they even licensed? I don't know that.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know the answer to that, so perhaps Mr. Orner can answer, but I do know one thing that I thought of as people were talking is, remember, every time your credit's run, it affects your credit rating again too. And so, you know, the more people have to do this, you know, as people come up, clearly they've never been denied for an apartment. You know, you can't keep going back, your credit keeps going in the toilet. I don't know the answer to the first part of your question though, as to whether or not they're standardized.
Madam Chair, they are bound by the same laws at the federal and state level, the Fair Credit Reporting Act and state laws regarding this industry. The standards vary tremendously depending on the landlord's needs and the quality and ability of the screening company. They are not licensed. Madam Chair, if I could also mention, we do have Brian Keating here, who is a representative of a large national screening company. There are a dozen or more such companies who do business in Minnesota. He's prepared to respond to questions about the difficulty of one state being different than all the others and what it would do to the ability to screen, as well as others who have agreed not to testify in the interest of time.
Thank you. Representative Morgan.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My question is for Mr. Horner. Mr. Horner, I was a landlord myself in the past, so I'd like you to help me walk through a little bit of the process here that we currently use, or the landlords currently use, is screening and signing a lease and having a tenant move in. Currently, somebody comes to visit to see an apartment that you are owning or a landlord is owning, and at some point they fill out an application. From the point they fill out the application and that is sent in then to a screening company, about how long is time lag is typical there?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, I am told by the experts behind me 3 to 4 days. There are companies that offer a much quicker turnaround, maybe check a lesser database. But
excuse me, Madam Chair, I think the testify is getting ahead of me there. I haven't gotten to that part yet, but the time to submit it from once an application is submitted, to submit it to the screening company, sir.
A wide variation, 3 to 4, seems to be what I'm hearing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then my next question is, once the screening application is submitted, how long is the turnaround in getting it back to the landlord?
Rather than secondhand, there are people who know this from direct experience. When the screening company, well, I can answer that. When the screening company screens it, they will return it almost immediately, either by fax or email or whatever method they use. So there's a quick turnaround from the completion of the report to get it back to the landlord.
Madam Chair, I think I heard testimony earlier that it was somewhere around 4 to 10 days. Mm-hmm. Often was the time, but okay, thank you very much. At that point, what is a typical turnaround, and perhaps some of the landlords behind you can tell you, what is the typical turnaround between receiving that screening from the screening company and actually offering and then signing a lease with the applicant?
Ms. Jotman, I believe.
Hi, if I may speak to that.
Could you introduce yourself again to the table?
Oh, hi. My name is Mark Ottens again. As soon as we know that an applicant has been approved or denied, we communicate that to the applicant. You know, if someone is approved, obviously we want to sign up with them as quick as possible. Then just getting back to the length of time it takes to screen, something like a credit check or a criminal check can be done very quickly. Some of the data on the county level may take a few days to get back, and especially if it's out of state. What can take some time is if you're verifying income. And it's not really on our part where the delay is. It's a delay in getting the information back from employers or other people that need to respond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not trying to criticize anybody about information. I'm trying to get a sense of the timeline here. Thank you. Just a couple more questions if I could clear up this timeline. Let's say that we can get the people in to sign the lease in a couple of days. What is the typical time lag between when a lease is signed and when the move-in actually occurs? Is it the next day? Is it a week or two? Is it a month or two? Is there a standard?
It'd be 1 to 2 months. The way we know 2 months out what availabilities we'll have, and we'll put them on the market immediately. And it's in our interest to rent it out as soon as possible. If the unit is vacant, they can move in the next day, but it would be right within that variance.
Okay, just one final comment then. According to the timeline established here, it seems to me that under current practices, there are probably more than a month, if not close to 2 months, between the screening for a criminal background check and the actual move-in. So though I appreciate the testimony of the police officers who are here, and though I really respect the efforts they're making in their communities and in my community as well to help landlords keep bad tenants out of our communities, it seems like the current process has about a 60-day lag in it between the criminal background check and move-in, just like would be occurring under Representative Lesh's bill. So I'd just like to make that comment, and then I'll pass back the mic.
The next witness is Representative Moe. We'll put some line here.
Just a follow-up to that
point.
I didn't hear the same thing that Representative Morgan heard. I heard the testifiers say that they could move in the next day if the apartment was vacant, and the reason it would take 30 to 60 days is because the apartment is currently occupied. That if the process could take as short as a few hours and the tenant could be moving in conceivably, and it may take 30 to 60 days because that's when the apartment was advertised for that occupancy and someone's currently living there and the person applying is looking for a place 30 to 60 days out. They're not looking for a place in 1 day.
Right. One thing that, there would be a bit of a lag. If I rent to someone and 60 days later they move in, is it possible they go out and commit a felony during that time? Of course. A bill like this would actually double that because, I could have something, it's a report that's 60 days old. They had committed a felony, now it's another 60 days. And so it's just making, the information the current is better. And if it gets more and more stale, it has less value.
Okay.
One more quick
we're going to go down the line here because we're going to vote on this bill today. So I'll come back to you. I just want to make sure that we get a chance to everybody who's asked to speak. Representative Mo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is to Representative Morgan and Representative McNamara's point. I think my understanding of Representative Morgan's point was that if somebody who's looking for a home, this could extend that period of time before they actually find one considerably. Am I correct? Yeah. Okay. So not quite the exact issue that I think Representative McNamara was talking about. My question is for Representative Lesh. The opposition to this bill has made some significant accusations about the security that are going to be provided for landlords with the certified background check that's going to come forward. Could you just respond to that? I think there's maybe a difference of information we're getting here about the accountability in that process.
First of all, Madam Chair, Representative Moe, thank you for the opportunity to respond to that, because I think there has been some substantial misunderstanding about this. As to the last gentleman who testified, the new landlord, I've been in that position as well. You need to up here, you need to make sure you check Cook County quite often. And in this situation, he wouldn't have had that problem. If he had a uniform report, it had already been checked. We use NCIC. That's nationwide. And it would be right on there. It would not be a situation where you're just checking the individual location. So, in terms of a report like this, we'd ensure that all that is already covered, and you wouldn't be in a position where you'd have to ask point blank, someone promised me you never lived in Chicago, because you'd already have the information right there. Furthermore, you've seen, people up here who are in a business, and we're all in business to make money. I'm certainly not going to get rich at the legislature. So, I do my landlord thing, and, we have a business to run, and we got to keep solvent. We don't want too many onerous burdens placed on us as landlords.
The police officers are in a little bit different position. They're in the job to ensure we have crime-free housing. And the points that they brought up about that, the 60-day problem, which has been brought up also, and despite what's said, it's not a consecutive time where it gets doubled. That's concurrent time on this because you can commit, a felony at any time. As a prosecutor, oftentimes I see people where we're in a position where someone gets a subsequent conviction. And remember, these are convictions. These have been in the court system for a while. The quickest, I don't know when I've had a conviction from arrest to conviction sooner than a three-month period of time. So they're already in the pipeline. They already have had problems prior to that. Furthermore, the certified copy, a lot of the arguments that have been made about how do we know something hasn't happened in the interim, and how do we know this thing is certified, and there's all kinds of fraud going on there, that's the point of what the Attorney General is going to do in consultation with the landlords and everyone else. Some people say, well, we don't know what this is going to be. Well, that's why they will be part of the process to ensure that everyone is very satisfied with this uniform application. Some people may not like the fact that they have to do the uniform application, but if they have to do it, they're going to be satisfied that it covers everybody.
Just a quick follow-up. So, Representative Lesh, you conceivably there could be some accessible database supporting this universal application that could verify its validity.
There could be. That is not a part of the bill. It would make things easier. It would further bypass the tenant screening companies who, as you've heard, are already concerned about losing profit, and understandably so. But there could be one. My thought was that, we include the tenant screening companies in this process as well and say, okay, how are we going to make this work for you? And if the landlord has to call up because the original is with them, that's fine. But I would say in court, we use certified copies all the time. I mean, we have something you can reasonably rely on has not been altered. That exists in law of the documents that we have, certified documents under the rules of evidence. It has those standards, and a landlord should reasonably be able to rely upon it. It should be good enough for everyone.
Thank you.
Okay, we're back to Representative Benson, McNamara, and the Metro Lane. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesh, I'm just wondering, if we could resolve some of these concerns that the opposition has by, for example, providing a potential renter a statement from the screening company that the screening had taken place and that they had it on file electronically. Would that resolve a problem in the sense that whatever company was potentially going to rent an apartment could simply call the screening company and ask from a list of needs that they might have that they would like maybe a criminal report, but they don't need the other kinds of reports that would be on this general screening report. That kind of a procedure still allow your bill to achieve its objective?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I think it would. Remember that the focus of this bill is only on if you charge a fee. So again, if they opted not to charge a fee, they free reign, they do whatever they want. But the opposition here wants the opportunity to be able to charge their own fee. And in that case, I would say, well, a screening company would be able to say, okay, if we only want this, we want to provide it over the phone. And if you as a landlord are satisfied with getting that information over the phone, then yeah, that would be under the purview of this bill.
The screening company could fax to the landlord whatever information he or she would like to acquire, could they not?
I anticipate the answer would be yes to that.
So then would that not resolve the problem of whether or not the potential renter had a fraudulent certificate? They would simply have a document indicating that a screening had taken place and it was in the control of the screening company, which then the renting company could request.
Madam Chair, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Back to Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question's a pretty short one. I'd like to ask Mr. Horner and Representative Lesh, the author of the bill, is there a chance that a homeless person would spend more time on the street if we pass this bill?
Mr. Horner?
I'm not sure. The clear effect, I think, would be that there would be people who would be disillusioned and led astray. I mean, the essence of our testimony, and we believe the essence of the problem, is that you will have a large number of tenants, applicants, whether homeless or in whatever other circumstances, who will be given a piece of paper that they paid a premium for, $50, and they're told it's acceptable everywhere, but in reality, it's accepted almost nowhere. I mean, that's kind of the fundamental problem, whether someone's homeless or not. And I think also, if I could just respond to Representative Benson's question, also the essence of the bill is a universally accepted screening. Right now, of course, you have individual landlords requesting individual information from individual screening companies, whatever they want. That's the way it works now. The essence of the bill is that you'd have a form that must be accepted universally around the state, whether another landlord filled it out, whether a tenant screening company filled it out, and you have no idea what the standards are. So maybe there was just a couple of questions responded to, but it must be accepted as though it were the comprehensive uniform report. That's kind of the essence of the problem, Madam Chair.
Mr. Horner, I have a question about this. There's nothing to prevent the landlord from doing additional screening. It's just that they couldn't charge again for it, isn't that correct,
Madam Chair.
Okay, let's just be clear about that. Representative Lesh, did you want to respond to Representative McNair's
question? I would just say, again, to reiterate some of the confusion, I think there's a lot of confusion. As you stated, you don't have to accept this report. No landlord has to accept this report. It's only if you decide to charge a fee that you have to accept that as the criteria. You cannot charge over and above what this says. And if you do charge a fee, you can't charge an additional fee if they already have it done. That's all. Mm-hmm. In response to Representative McNamara's question, I have no idea how this could be construed as having a homeless person spend more time on the street. If a homeless person only has to pay a fee once rather than multiple fees, it strikes me that they're in a lot better position to do that. And as we know, homeless has a fluctuating definition these days. You know, you live out of a car 2 days out of your week, and then you're with your cousin where you can't stay very long. But if you pull enough money together to screen for one, I would think that this would help the homeless population.
Madam Chair, my point being that I think there's an opportunity that this process could be slower than the free market system we currently have, and I think that's got the potential to put someone on the street longer and unnecessarily so. And for that reason, Madam Chair, I request a roll call vote on this.
That's fine. We will have a roll call vote. I believe, Representative Susan, you might, maybe we can end up here with the last question here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my question would be to the author of the bill. Do we know how many people are actually requesting more than one credit check? What percentage of those credit checks that go out there? Any idea?
Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, I don't know the answer to that. I do know in the times that I've applied for apartments, I've seen the effect of it on my credit report, but I don't know the percentage in Minnesota of how many people request multiple times.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess there's a couple concerns I have with this bill. Number one is that the current credit system check that we have is tailored towards the landlord, so we can keep the fees down. With a universal credit check like this, I see $50 as being kind of a minimum, and then if it goes above that, who eats those costs? As a Cadillac, I think it addresses some of the issues. It doesn't address all of the issues. And I think the second concern I have with the cost driver is the 60-day rule. As we had testimony from the police, I think there are many factors that play into the 60-day rule that open the bill up to and the procedure up to significant abuse. And I guess for those two paramount reasons, I will be voting against the bill. But you do great poems, Representative Lesh.
I'll do one for this if you'll get it to vote for it.
Okay. Representative Lesh, any final comments on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I guess final comments I would state that, you know, some money interests have lobbyists paid to bring a lot of people down here to testify in opposition to this bill. I'd ask you to think about your constituents who are only represented here by some legal aid folks who have a lot of bills they're trying to gather support for. And think about those folks in your districts who have to pay this multiple times.
Think about, you know, someone came up here and said, you know, listen, you either got a good credit report or you've got a bad credit report. We know whether we're going to rent to you. That's a person who's never been denied an apartment. And if you've been denied an apartment, I've been denied an apartment. Back early on in college, I didn't have adequate employment. I was going to school. I was trying to make it. If you've been denied, you know a reason. It's a cycle. It's a downward spiral, and it makes it far more difficult. But if you just have that one foothold where you're able to say, hang on, I paid $50 this once, and I would add this two things. There are a couple of things that are potentially negotiable here in future committees. That is the timeline, and that is the fee. If it's unacceptable, because I've spoken with Mr. Horner a little bit, but haven't had the opportunity to talk with many of the other people here who have voiced concerns that I think come from misunderstandings in the bill, we can talk about that. But if you're in a position where you're able to pay that $50 just once and have an opportunity to at least present it to someone multiple times over a couple-month period, it's going to help out those constituents of yours and make a big difference, especially for those who are families, maybe single parents. Other than that, I would say that absolutely landlords have different standards. Landlords can continue to apply those different standards, but they're under certain legal requirements that they cannot illegally discriminate, and we provide all the information and will provide all the information that they're going to need in screening this tenant. If they have some, you know, sort of different type of deal that's special to them, well, they can consider that and they can pay for it. Trying to think. There were a couple other points, Madam Chair. And just lastly, with the concern about what makes it certified, how can we rely on the certified? That will be worked out with the Attorney General. We will ensure that there is a form that you can rely on and you can factually rely on. We do that, as I stated, in the courts all the time. Landlords can be sure that this is a form when they receive it that they know it's accurate. It works with car titles. It works with insurance cards. It works with things across the board if you need to verify that someone actually has what they say they have. And lastly, the final point is we're willing to work with the tenant screening companies, the landlords, multi-housing, and everyone to ensure that this is a fair process, provided we get it through.
Okay. And just as a reminder, this bill does go to the Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee, where I think some of these legal questions will be addressed probably even more vigorously. Mm-hmm. So with that, Representative Krantz reiterates his
yes.
motion and that this bill be passed and be referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. So we'll call the roll.
Representative Clark?
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Benson?
Yes.
Representative Eastland?
No.
Representative Huntley?
No.
Representative Kranz?
Yes.
Representative Blaine?
Yes.
Representative Medor?
Yes.
Representative McFarlane?
No.
Representative McNamara?
No.
Representative Moe?
Yes.
Representative Morgan?
Yes.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Swales?
No.
Representative Shumper?
Yes.
I'm here.
Sorry, Representative Peterson.
No.
Okay, there are 8 nays and 8 ayes. The bill does not pass. And, we'll lay it over. Okay, with that, the committee is adjourned.